stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here with us. Mr. David Toscano in the studio. Morning, David.
Good morning. It's great to be back. It's been a long time.
Well, 1 year. Actually, more than 1 year. You were so busy at the start of December. Were you partying after the November elections?
Well, I'll tell you, unprecedented elections. We had an audacious goal of trying to get 17 seats in the Virginia House of Delegates. We got 15 right now, and we're still in the throes of trying to determine whether we'll get the next two.
Yeah, that's what we're going to be talking about as part of our hour. David Toscano, Virginia House of Delegates Democratic leader from the 57th District. That's Charlottesville. David is on the committees of courts of justice, rules, transportation, so much to talk about during our hour. Thank you for being here with us. A busy man and coming down to visit WPVC Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. So there's so many topics that we can talk about, so many things to discuss, but certainly the thing that has all the news, the topic that has all the discussion across the country. When I was doing my research, I found a Los Angeles Times, I forget the topic, the news in England. I forget the
Brexit.
No, not Brexit. Well, although Brexit is that's the topic, but the newspaper in England. But the 94th district, the Newport News district, is the Yancey versus Simmons race. Started out with 10 votes being the difference, an automatic recount. Nobody filing for a recount. That's just automatic recount. The recount comes to be Yancey being ahead by 10. The automatic recount determines that Simmons wins by 1. The House of Republicans as a group says, oh, well, Simmons, the Democrat, wins, so we'll come up and everybody will work together. And then
they say, never mind.
Then Mr. Yancey says, wait a minute, I'm filing for another recount.
It's truly bizarre. It really is truly bizarre. I mean, who would have thought that an election that occurred over a month and a half ago would still be going on, not just in that district, but and there's another district that's even more problematic in some ways. But the story in the Yancey Shelley Simons District 94, which is just Newport News, is that you're right. On November 7th, the vote totals were Yancey up by 10 votes at the end of that night. There's an automatic recount, and they did the recount. And a recount is something where groups of observers from Democrats and Republicans get together and they look at ballots that they can't, that the essentially the machine spit out because it couldn't read the ballot. And they try to discern the intent of the voter based on what the marks are on the paper ballot. So they look at all these ballots. And at the end of it, the Republicans and the Democratic observers, as well as all the election officials, say, okay, we have now identified 11 more votes for Shelley Simons. That gets 11 net votes for Shelley Simons. That gets her to a one-vote victory in the recount. Technically speaking, since this is a judicial proceeding, judges have to sign off on the recount. And they were scheduled to come in the next day and sign off on what everybody had already signed off on, a one-vote win. The Republican Party put out a nice press advisory saying, yeah, well, we're now at 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans in the House of Delegates. We'll figure out a way to work together in a power-sharing arrangement so we can get things done. That was the night before. And then the next morning, a Republican operative comes in and says, wait a minute here. I forgot to contest one ballot that's in that box over there. And if you judges open that box up, you will find that ballot. I want to contest it. Well, the Democratic lawyers are going ballistic at that point, saying, you can't do this. You've already agreed that she's already won by one vote. Well, the Republicans were able to prevail upon the judges. They looked at the ballot for 2 hours trying to figure out what it really meant. And the fact that they couldn't figure that out for 2 hours probably indicated that it was really hard to discern the intent of the voter. Ultimately, they counted that vote for David Yancey. That got him back to a tie. And that's where we are right now, in a tie.
So for folks who, I would think that many people have read a basic article about this, whether they've read what I call first paragraphers, folks who've read the headline and read the first paragraph. But not everyone has read enough about the article or seen a picture of this ballot. Can you tell us a little bit about the ballot itself and why it might be so difficult to discern the intent?
Okay, sure. That's a really good question. And if people go on websites, they can look at the ballot, they actually see it. And it's like a lot of the ballots we see around here, where people would come and they would fill in a bubble right next to the name that they want to vote for. So this ballot had two bubbles filled in. It had a bubble filled in for Simons and a bubble filled in for Yancey.
Yancey being the Republican, yes, Simons being the Democrat.
And then it had a little, like a scratch mark across the Simons bubble, just a line through the bubble as well. There were other things on the ballot as well. The person had voted for Gillespie, but that also had a line through the bubble. That person didn't vote twice in the gubernatorial race, just once. The person voted twice, essentially, in the delegates race, and then put that line in there. Now, technically, people call that an overvote, that they voted twice for the same seat, and you're sort of supposed to throw out that vote. But for some reason, the judges concluded that because of the mark across the Simons bubble, it indicated that the person was taking back their vote for Simons and had now decided to vote for Yancey. And that's how Yancey got the vote. So, I mean, there is some logic to it if you think of it. But if you're just looking at that ballot, it's really hard to figure out whether there's any intention expressed by all those various marks.
But my understanding was that the decision was made for the Republican, was that all the other votes on the ballot was also for Republicans.
Well, that was part of the argument that the Republicans made. They said, well, if you look at the rest of the ballot, all of the other bubbles were for Republicans, so why shouldn't this person vote for a Republican in the delegate seat? But that's not the way the judges are supposed to determine it, because, as you know, people vote for different people from different parties on the same ballot all the time. They're supposed to try to figure out what was the intention of the voter as to that particular race. And that's why you would have to look to see if the bubble was filled in correctly, if a line was drawn underneath the person indicating that that's who they wanted to vote for. If the person's name was circled, that would clearly indicate that's who they wanted to vote for. In this case, it was hard because there were two bubbles, one for the Democrat and one for the Republican. They were both filled out totally. And the only difference was that one scratch mark across the bubble of the Democrat. Therefore, the judges concluded that shouldn't be counted for the Democrat, but instead for the Republican.
Which was also done for the Republican in the governor's race.
Yes.
Again, a Sunday morning wake-up call here. Our guest today on the last day of 2017, David Toscano. Representative from the 57th District. Thanks for coming in. I'm sure you have many other things to do today, and we appreciate you visiting us as one of your tasks.
Well, it's always great to come here.
As we talk about the 94th District, one of the slams made towards the Democrats was a quote from, I believe, Mr. Cox in the Republican side, is a quote that says, Democrats sought to litigate their way to victory because I believe Ms. Simons has now start to stop this the draw. She said, don't count that vote. You've brought things to a tie by counting that last vote. You can't count that. I'm taking things to court so that you don't count that vote.
Well, she has asked the judges to look at their decision and see if the judges still agree that their decision was the right one. And that's her right under the law to do. And she's being criticized by the Republicans for doing it. But when you have a one-vote margin, it doesn't make sense to just leave everything on the table and cast her lot with a coin toss, which essentially she would be doing if she didn't ask the judges to review their decision. Now, the problem is that at some point, the constituents of the 94th District have to have somebody representing them in the House of Delegates. And we're getting very close to the time where some decisions have to be made, or when we return on January 10th, no one will be sitting in that seat for the 94th. And I think the Simons campaign feels very strongly that somebody should be representing that district when we get to Richmond. So we don't know how this is all turning out. There is a schedule for a coin toss. I use coin toss. They actually draw name by a lot to determine the winner if there's still a tie. And there is a time set for that for Thursday morning. So my guess is that we may have a result in this election as early as Thursday morning. And then we'll see if the Republicans want to challenge that if we win the coin toss, because they've blustered a lot about continuing to challenge and not seat Shelley Simons if she's declared the lawful winner.
So if I understood that right, if Mr. Yancey wins the coin toss or the drawing of the name, then they may say, never mind, we'll accept the draw, no more court.
No more court, right.
We know that the legislature reconvenes on January 10th.
Yes.
When do the new delegates get assigned to committees?
Right after we reconvene on January 10th. It'll either be that day or the day after. The first thing we do when we get down there is everybody is sworn in to take their seats so they can vote. Then we elect a Speaker of the House and we elect a Clerk of the Court. Technically, the Speaker has appointed people to committees, so you got to have a Speaker before you can appoint people to committees. The appointments usually occur either the first day of session in the evening or the second or third day of session at the latest, so we can get going with doing our business. But we have to reorganize in order to have committees set. And the problem we have with the 94th is if nobody is the winner, nobody can be seated to represent the 94th, so they won't have representation in voting for the Speaker. They won't have representation in voting for the rules. They won't have any representation. That wouldn't be a good thing for citizens in the 94th District.
Is there a way to have both there?
Well, how would you determine how they would vote? You would have a hard time doing it. You'd have to have one or the other has to be sworn in. And the Republicans have basically said they're not going to allow Shelley Simons to take her seat if she's declared the lawful winner without some contest. So I think one of the interesting things that will happen the first day will be a lot of procedural maneuvering as to who's going to be seated to represent the 94th district. It'll be interesting to watch, but it will not be fun for us on the floor trying to figure out what's going to happen.
And so if we do go to court, I mean, it just seems like things are not going to happen quickly.
Right.
And because everything's going to be appealed,
right?
Whoever loses is going to be appealed. No one's going to give up. Even if Mr. Yancey wins, despite how nice and wonderful the Democrats may feel that Ms. Simons is, she's not going to give up because she wants to fairly represent the Democrats in her district.
Yes, the people who voted for her and really supported her. That's always the dilemma you have in this situation. That was the dilemma that Al Gore had back in 2000, you know, with the hanging chads in Florida. He ultimately decided that he was going to stop fighting because he didn't think it was good for the country to continue to litigate the case. And you'd like to think that people on both the Republican and the Democratic side will say at some point, look, we got to stop this. The people of the 94th district should be represented on January 10th. Whoever it is, you know, so be it. If it's by a coin flip, so be it. But they should have representation. Whether we'll get to that point, it's not all clear to me. I mean, I am basically a collaborative person. I like to figure out ways to collaborate. I'd like to find a way to collaborate on this one so that those people in the 94th can have representation.
I think I have a quote here from you that says, Democrats know Virginians are watching. They'll see us standing together and standing up for the votes they cast this year. 230,000 more for House Democrat candidates statewide than for Republicans. What we won't stand for is D.C.-style scorched earth politics. This seems to apply to the 94th district as well as to that quote, which seems to be more state-related.
Right. And again, I think that cooler heads ought to try to prevail in this situation, and we should come up with a way that we can get somebody seated in the 94th district. Hopefully, we can also come up with a way that we can share power, real power, in the House of Delegates, because even if a Republican is seated in the 94th, the balance of power is going to be 51 Republicans and 49 Democrats. That's almost parity. And it makes sense to talk about how you share power in that kind of arrangement, how you set up the committee so that they have equal members on each committee, how you appoint chair people to committees, how you appoint people to all of these boards and commissions that we appoint around the Commonwealth. How do we get our work done in a bipartisan fashion that serves our constituents? We'd like to work towards a power-sharing arrangement. It remains to be seen whether the Republicans are going to try to force their way if they get to 51-49.
We also have the 28th district in Fredericksburg, where 147, I believe, ballots were given to the wrong district race. Although Republican Mr. Thomas won by 73 votes.
Isn't that the wildest thing in the world?
And then you can't go back and ask, I don't know the proper name, the title of the person who set the district, and say, how did you manage to make that mistake? Because that person is now deceased.
Right. Well, you know, that's a function of a couple of things. One, it's a function of how redistricting and gerrymandering works. Sometimes the way these lines are drawn, they draw the district lines right down the middle of a street. And so your neighbors, you live on one side of the street, neighbor lives on the other side of the street. You're coming into the same polling booth, but you're getting different ballots because you're actually in different delegate districts. In this case, what happened was someone wasn't paying attention to the lines, and they gave the wrong ballots to people who wanted to vote in one district but were given a ballot for candidates in a different district. So their ballots didn't count in the district where they had to elect the representative. That strikes you as the ultimate disenfranchisement of somebody who might have wanted to come to vote for someone and didn't get a chance to because they were given the wrong ballot. And there are 147 of those ballots out there, more than double the margin of victory for the Republican in that district. The Democrats have filed a federal case arguing voter disenfranchisement and have asked for a totally new election. The Washington Post, I think the Richmond Times-Dispatch, a number of newspaper outlets have said, look, this is a tainted election. You can't fix it unless you have a new election. And so that's what we're arguing there. It's hard to know whether we'll get it, but that's what the argument's about.
Do you think it's possible that new elections in these two districts might take place in May of 2018 or November of 2018 so that these two representatives might serve in January through March of this year, but may not be there in January through March of next year?
Yeah, and I know this is really, really complicated, and it gets, you know, into this all this lawyerese, so please excuse me.
But your title, which...
That's right. I'm a lawyer, right? And I spent 2 hours on the phone with lawyers this morning about this. But the 94th, there will not be a new election. That will not occur. That'll either be resolved with a coin flip, or somebody will be seated at some point in the session. It may not be January 10th. So there won't be a new election in the 94th. There could be a new election in the 28th, and then the question becomes, does somebody sit in the seat until that election occurs, which probably would occur sometime during the General Assembly session? My guess is a court, if they were to order a new election, would probably say that somebody ought to be sitting in that seat, at least to give that representation to that district, while this new election is happening. That's just a guess, because I'm not... You know, I'm not the Court of Appeals here, but
you're an attorney, not a judge.
I'm not a judge, not a judge. But, you know, you would think again that you would want to have representation from that district to represent those citizens while the a new election is happening.
Again, our guest today, David Toscano. He's the Democratic leader of the Virginia House of Delegates and representing in the 57th district here on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We'll be right back. Back in action on the 31st of December. Happy New Year to everybody. In just a few hours, very few hours if you're listening in New Zealand. Hey, David, the phone is ringing. Check out that ringing. And that goes to David Toscano. We'll be getting the phone. Caller, are you with us?
Hi, yes.
What would you like to question or comment?
Well, in the Yancey Simon election, I worked the polls, not in that case, but in Nelson County. And if both bubbles are colored in on a ballot, that ballot is kicked out as an overvote. And then you ask the voter, do you mean to vote for both people or do you want a new ballot? And if they say, yes, I told people I'd vote for each of them, I want to vote for each of them, the poll worker has to override the machine for that ballot to be taken. So when that voter cast their ballot, it was kicked out as an overvote. And they said, yes, I want both bubbles covered in order for the ballot to be taken. So for the judges to say that the voter meant to vote for one over the other is against all the election rules that we're given to follow when somebody casts an overvote. So I don't know if that... I don't know if it's a done decision or not, but certainly the Democratic lawyers could argue that there's an intent would have to have been shown by the ballot even being overridden.
Boy, I'm glad she called because she's got it right on the money. That's the way the system is supposed to work. Our Democratic lawyers argued that the judges didn't apply the law in the way it was supposed to be applied because otherwise you couldn't give that vote to Yancey. And we continue to argue that. You know, that's what our motion to reconsider before the judge is all about. And we'll just have to see if they reverse themselves. If they do, Shelley Simons will win by one vote. If they don't, we'll get a coin flip.
Caller, thanks all so right, much. So Go ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you. I just wanted to... put that on the scale of the Democratic vote being the one that should have, the Democratic candidate being the one that should be seated.
All right. Thank you so much.
I'm with you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, that's, I didn't say that to you. I've said that to others. I've questioned that. I'm like, if you do that, doesn't the machine spit that out right when you, when I hand my, vote to somebody there. I voted here in Albemarle County. By the way, if somebody else wants to call, it is 434-284-9470. That's it is 94.7 WPVC. So it's 434-284-9470 with David Toscano here. When I voted in Albemarle County, I had a bubble vote as well. And so I'm reading this article about the problem in the 94th District. And I thought, well, if I had done that and filled it out incorrectly and handed it to the poll district volunteer, wouldn't it have spit it out right then?
That's the way it's supposed to be. And why it is that that ballot somehow got into consideration is not at all clear, except it was in the pile of votes that had been rejected. But I think the caller was absolutely right. This, you disqualify these overvotes and give people a chance to correct their vote. And I guess the judges concluded that the correction was in the form of this line, which cancels out the Simons vote. But that's not the way we can figure it out. We think that there is no clear intention to vote for either one, and therefore the vote should not be counted for Yancey, the Republican, and Shelley Simons would win by one vote.
I just thought that, and not to put this on the volunteer, I'm not blaming a volunteer, but that it would have gone, as the voter, you would have been standing there to make sure it went through, and you would have said, oh, can I have another one then so I can go vote again? Anyway, so call up if you have a question or a comment at 434-284-9470.
Yeah, we're claiming they shouldn't even have looked at that vote.
So David, so we don't just talk about this. Let's talk about some other things. Because the January 10th, the legislature will reconvene. So I'm curious as to some bills that you may have on your list to put out there.
Sure.
What do you have that you can share with us?
Sure. Well, I came in here with my booklet that people can't see.
I see. But, you have a three-ring binder that looks like it's got it's not overflowing, but it looks like it's got 100 pages
There are a lot in here. And, of course, it starts very early in the year where people start giving me ideas for legislation that we should propose. But let's take one thing I think people are very interested in this area. That is legislation that flows from August 11th and 12th.
The Hafey report.
Well, the Hafey report, the state report, the death of Heather Heyer, the demonstrations. So I've got a couple of bills that try to address some of the problems with what happened here on August 11th and 12th. One, for example, is right now there is a statute that allows certain number of localities to prohibit the carrying of weapons in public places. Charlottesville and Albemarle is not on that list, so legally we can't have an ordinance like that. But what one of my bills does is add Charlottesville and Albemarle to the list of localities that can pass these local ordinances that would prohibit the carrying of loaded firearms in public places. That's one. Two, I've got a bill that will clarify that localities have the ability to control monuments in their public spaces. There's a lot of dispute about whether people can do it or not, localities can do it or not. So I put in a bill that said, look, you know, Loudoun County may be different than Frederick County, than Spotsylvania County, than Charlottesville. All of them have public monuments. They have war memorials. They have this, that, and the other thing in public parks, in public spaces. Some people want to keep those memorials. Some people don't. Why not give those people in those localities the ability to control their destiny and figure out for themselves what's in the best interest of their locality? Now, you know, I've had lots of different views about the memorials here and whether they should be removed, be recontextualized, or what. But one thing I'm very clear on, and that is the decision on things like that should be a local decision and not be one made by folks in Richmond who don't have any idea of the local conditions in Charlottesville or Loudoun County. So that's another one I got. I've got a memorial resolution for Heather Heyer that I'm putting in. So those are just three of them right out of the box on August 11th and 12th. There probably will be some other firearms type of legislation that has to do with how we better coordinate state and local responses to demonstrations like this, the ability for localities to prohibit firearms or any weapons within 1,000 feet of a demonstration, to give localities more tools to deal with what happened on August 11th and 12th in this community.
Again, our guest today, Tava Toscano. He is from the 57th District, your Virginia House of Delegates, and the Democratic leader here on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, WPVC.
You want me to keep going with more? I got more.
Hey, whatever you got. I want to take a moment and talk about the loaded guns. No loaded guns in Charlottesville, public areas in Charlottesville, Albemarle County. Define that a little bit more for me.
The way that would work, you know, Virginia is what is called a Dillon Rule state. Dillon Rule goes back to an old case that said that if the state doesn't give a locality the ability to do something, they can't do it. So under our Dillon Rule state, if we're not given the authority by the state government to regulate firearms in certain public places, we can't do it. What my bill would do is give us the authority to create an ordinance that would say you can't carry loaded weapons into a public space like McIntyre Park, Emancipation Park, Justice Park. We would pass an ordinance if we wanted to. If we didn't want to or it couldn't get passed, then it wouldn't get passed. But if we wanted to, we could, and therefore we could put those prohibitions in place. Right now, it's questionable whether we can do that. So we got to get the bill, we got to get the law changed so we can do it. And Albemarle would have the same issue. They could do it as well. They could do it for certain public places, but not other public places. They would make their own decision. Again, it'd be local.
Is Preston Avenue a public place? So if somebody had a loaded gun in their car while they were driving.
Usually there's some exceptions for the public on streets, but that's part of what the ordinance would have to develop. And that's part of what the statute have to develop. The statute right now is very broad. It says you can develop these ordinances. And then the locality has to develop the ordinance and figure out, define what the public place would be.
Is having the gun within 500 yards of a school?
Well, we already have some prohibitions on that. But the common thing, the one I think people worry most about is, I don't know if you hunt. There are a lot of people who hunt around here, right?
Yep.
I mean, they drive maybe from Scottsville through Charlottesville to go north to hunt in Greene County, right? You don't want to create a situation where they can't travel through Charlottesville with their firearm, their rifle to get to the hunting spot. So you got to have some exceptions so that you don't, you know, impinge on that right or that privilege that people feel they have. So there always have to be exceptions within the general rule. But the general rule just sets up how the locality could develop an ordinance that would work for them.
Again, Tava Toscano here in Sunday Morning Wake Up Call Studio WPVC. You're welcome to call and ask a question, 434-284-9470, or make your comment. We don't always have Tava Toscano here, but one day out of the year, take advantage. Take advantage. Monuments and memorials. So currently, Charlottesville has, I mean, I guess part of what happened on, I mean, you can't even pick a date because it's happened multiple dates out of the year, is because moving the statues has not been allowed through the court system. And that is one of the reasons, I'm assuming, why you would like to put this, why you're proposing this bill, correct?
Yes, because it brings some certainty to a process that seems somewhat chaotic, arbitrary, and unclear.
The goal of moving the statue, someone else said, no, I don't want to move the statue. We should be allowed to have it out here in a public space. And so, therefore, we're in the court system.
Well, yeah, that's where you are now. If my bill were to pass, then all would have to happen is the city council will decide we're going to move it, and that's it. Now, I am toying with some ideas that might put a referendum requirement into that bill. I haven't figured out exactly if I'm going to do that. Some people around here have argued that there should be a referendum requirement of some sort. I don't usually like to do government by referendum, but sometimes some of these issues are so large and so significant for a community that referendum might make some sense. I don't know how a referendum would turn out in terms of moving the statues in Charlottesville.
Explain that a little bit for everybody when you talk about a referendum.
You would put something on the November ballot and it would say something like, should the Robert E. Lee statue be moved from the park? Question mark. And then people would fill in their bubbles, and hopefully they would fill in two bubbles.
They'd only fill in one.
They'd only fill in one. And it would be an advisory referendum for the city council. It wouldn't be a mandatory referendum. But that would be one way you could do that. We have referendum all the time. I mean, there's an issue about referendum in terms of moving the courthouses out of Charlottesville. Because under certain parts of state law, you have to have a referendum to move a courthouse. So you find referendum in state statute and state law something you have to do prior to the local government taking an action. So it would not be unprecedented. I just haven't determined whether it makes sense for this bill.
What about Richmond? I realize you don't live in Richmond. You don't represent Richmond. But certainly Richmond, with its display of monuments, having an African American as a mayor at the moment, what do you foresee as their issues with their statues?
Well, their issues are even larger than ours. I mean, if you think about Richmond in a historical context, and you think about how many monuments there are. They're not all, some are in public spaces and some are in private spaces. Some are in state spaces and some are local to Richmond. And they have been, I'm not intimately involved with what they're doing, but from afar, it looks like they're managing a public process in quite a good way to try to come up with some ways for the public to get their arms around this and deal with it. I don't know what it looks like eventually, but if my bill were to pass, the localities would have that control, and it wouldn't be in the hands of the state. It would apply to Richmond, not just Charlottesville.
But what happens if, or with your foresight, and I'm assuming that this is one of the reasons why you haven't made a final decision on how to put this bill in its final wording on how to introduce it. But the city council says this is what we're going to do, especially on such an issue that has been so...
divisive? I think divisive is a good word.
Great word. And they make it, and the decision, I mean, they've already decided what they want to do. I mean, they've covered it in black tarp. So they would decide to take it away. And so what happens next? And they've got a large group of people, or certainly at least a loud group of people, who don't want that to happen.
Yeah. Right now, it's not clear that they're going to be able to do it. The court has not finally ruled about whether they're going to be able to do it. There's been some thinking that the judge is leaning against allowing them to do it. So we really don't know. If my bill were to pass, then the localities would have the ability to do it. Whether they would have to take another vote or not, I don't know. I mean, there might be an argument that they might have to. But and whether they'd have to go through another public process, I don't know either. But they would ultimately have the ability to do it. And then the recourse for the voters would be, if you have a referendum requirement, you could impose that before you did it. Or if there was no referendum requirement, the referendum would occur when these councilors came up for election. You would either vote for them or not. And some people say that a lot of people voted in this election because of the monuments. It's hard to know. But ultimately, the elected officials have to answer to their voters for decisions that they make, and this would be one of them.
11:42 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call with our guest, David Toscano. Hang tight. And here we are back in the hour. David, let's go back to the Heafy report. So Charlottesville gets the report a few weeks ago. Doesn't take very many days after that before Charlottesville Police Chief Al Thomas resigns. Some people would say, I've read both sides of that, saying that he should have resigned, others saying that that others should have resigned, or he sort of took all the blame. I realize that I'm putting this on you to speak about it, but you're the only one in the studio. I'm curious as to what your thoughts on this in terms of Chief Al Thomas resigning after the report. Did he take a lot of the blame? Were there others? Should city council take a little more blame here?
Well, there's so much complexity in this issue, it's hard to get through in a 20-second soundbite, but...
You can have more time.
Oh, okay, great. Well, you know, there has to be some accountability for what happened. And, I mean, clearly the report said that the two major goals that the city should have, or a government should have, would be to keep us safe and to protect our rights. And neither of those two things happened. So what is going to be the end result of that? Are a bunch of people going to lose their jobs as a result? Well, we had an election, and the election partly had to do with August 11th to 12th. I'm not sure what the election tells us about that, but we had an election. Chief Thomas is gone. Certainly he was the point person for the logistics around the police presence. And, you know, there might be some argument that the buck stopped with him. Whether it goes farther or not is another question. The elected officials are kind of in a weird position because they are responsible for telling their appointed people, city manager and other folks, what they should be doing. They set the policy goals, and then the city officials implement those goals, and the city officials, whether it's Maurice Jones or whoever it is, will be judged on whether they did what the council said they should do. Now, I wasn't party to all those discussions, so I can't tell you whether that he did everything they said he was supposed to do. My sense is that there were lots of competing instructions being given by different counselors. And that's problematic, because in a situation like this, where we knew early on this would be a huge event, you can't give different instructions by different people. You have to speak with one voice. And the extent to which that broke down was problematic. And I hope that the council will do a lot of work to try to bring some consensus in how they're going to communicate to city management what should be done in situations like this in the future. But, you know, it's hard really to point fingers and say, well, you know, this person should go, this person should go. The best you can say is that there were some mistakes made along the way. People ought to try to own up to those mistakes. I think a lot of them are. And I think the public at some point has got to say, look, we're trying to put the best things in place to get us to the get us through the next year, make sure that if this happens again, it doesn't happen like it did this time, and give a little benefit of the doubt to these folks who are working really hard. These elected officials, A, are working really hard. The city management is working really hard. And at some point, we got to, you know, give them some slack to make sure that they can figure out what to do next is going to protect us and protect our rights.
So one of the people who's gotten a lot of negative grief back, received a lot of harsh words and comment, Mayor Signer. But his election isn't until next November.
Right.
Do you think that something like this will last that long in terms of harming his reelection if he chooses to run again?
It's really hard to say right now. I mean, I think that, you know, he was in a very, very difficult position. And, you know, I've been the mayor. I know what it's like to be in a difficult position. I don't think I've ever had anything anywhere near the kind of position he had to be in during that period of time. And people may make judgments about, you know, how well he did during that time. I can tell you this. I know that man works very, very hard. And I think that there have been some places where the criticism has been justified, and there have been a lot of places where the criticism has been totally unjustified. But people are looking for someone they can go after, and he was the person who was the face, and so they went after him. I hope that over time, you know, that the mayor working, well, you got the mayorship up for election because we got to elect a new mayor this January. My guess is you'll have a new mayor. But that over time, some of those feelings will be assuaged. People will feel better about the mayor. The mayor will, he won't be the mayor after January is my guess. And that they'll work through some of those problems, because if we don't, we'll continue to have a divided community. And that's not going to be good for anybody.
Do you think that any of the federal issues will come to play a role in this year's state work beginning January 10th?
Absolutely. So let's just take one example, healthcare. Let's take a second example, healthcare. Let's take a third example, healthcare. This election was all about healthcare. I mean, people are very, very troubled about their health insurance, their health security, and they know that Donald Trump has been trying to undermine the Affordable Care Act since he became president, and he's doing a masterful job, even though they technically have not repealed the law. In our area, for example, the folks who lost their insurance coverage and had to pick up the Optima coverage have got the largest increase in insurance premium rates in the country. And that's because the Trump administration has been undermining the marketplaces for insurance. So when you take different insurers out of the market, there's less competition, the prices go up, and we're feeling it here in Charlottesville. And so we got some big issues in Richmond to deal with around health insurance, Medicaid expansion. We have 400,000 Virginians who are in a coverage gap and don't have access to really good, very good insurance. We can fix that problem if we expand Medicaid, and we can bring our tax dollars back here to help people who are in need of insurance. I have a bill that will say that if an insurance company operates in Virginia and takes advantage of getting reimbursements from us in Medicaid for us paying them to provide services, that they ought to offer an insurance product throughout the state. So that Anthem, for example, would have to offer a product in Charlottesville that could then compete with Optima and therefore draw down the rates. So that's one bill that I've got that I'm putting in to hopefully help with this health insurance issue.
I love that.
It's a huge problem.
What about something like individual states signing the Paris Agreement.
Well, I think that's useful. I think that what we have to do in Virginia is open up the markets for solar and renewables in ways that we've never done before. So I've got a couple bills on that too. A couple of years ago, I had a bill passed which created pilot programs for what are called power purchase agreements, where a private developer would come to a school, for example, Albemarle, Woodbrook, whatever, and say, I'll put solar panels on your roof. You don't have to pay me for them, but I want to be able to have Dominion pay me for the excess energy I generate from those panels. And in that way, the schools didn't have upfront costs. The developer did the work, and it's been successful around the Commonwealth. I think we have to turn that into a permanent program. I've got a bill that will create a tax credit for energy storage facilities so that if you've got batteries and you're investing in them, you would get a tax credit and therefore be able to keep your energy on site rather than generate it on the roof of your house, send it out to the grid, and never get it back. So these are things we can do to encourage more renewables, because I think long-term, that's where we're going to have to be in terms of addressing our climate change problems.
When you get started in the, again, David Toscano here, 57th District and the Virginia House of Delegates, when you get started in the new legislature beginning January 10th, what do you start first? I mean, when you sit down, how do you know which new bills to introduce first?
Well, that's a great question. We have these what are called filing deadlines. We have to get most of our bills filed by January 10th so that we can assign them to committees. Part of my role as the Democratic leader is to try to put together what the Democratic agenda is. What set of bills are we really going to push? So we didn't talk about this, but, job creation and job opportunity is a huge issue for us. And so we'll have a bill that increases the minimum wage. And that will be one of our big bills. But that won't be the only one. We've got things related to paid family leave, which is a big economic insecurity issue for a lot of families who may want to take some paid family leave to watch a youngster and can't take it. So it's all about jobs and economic opportunity and trying to set the agenda for what we're trying to do as a Democratic caucus. That's part of my role. So you'll see in the first week in January a rollout of a series of initiatives that the Democrats will be taking along the lines of economic opportunity, investment in education, health care, renewables, protecting LGBT rights, women's rights. You'll see a whole series of those, and that's part of my role as being the Democratic leader, is to put them together.
54 minutes after the hour, just a few minutes left with David Toscano. I could not find where I saw this, so bear with me, and please let me know if this is correct. I believe that I read an article that said that you sent out a memo to others in the Democratic Party saying how important it was for the caucus to stay together. Please don't accept favors from the Republican Party to get your vote for something because we needed 49 or 50 votes at all times.
That's my role as the Democratic leader, is to make sure that we can stick together. Now, we never bind our caucus to vote on anything, but we like to bind our caucus to vote together on the really important things, like who's going to be elected Speaker of the House, because it's such a big position. And the feeling was that the Republicans would try to offer little inducements for some of our members to perhaps go and vote for the Speaker in exchange for getting a quality appointment to a committee or some other benefit. And I was just trying to encourage people to stick together. And of course, the memo was leaked and it ended up in the Washington Post. But I think most people understand that, you know, you sort of hang together or you hang separately, right? You know, you got to stick together if you're going to try to push an agenda that you want to have passed. And when you're at essentially a tie, you got to make sure you can keep all your votes together, and that's part of what I try to do.
I do want to tell people, I was looking for it, RichmondSunlight.com, which is a great website to go to. You can find, whether you want to find David's work, or you can find others, and you can look things up by the name of your representative. You can look things up by specific bills, the legislator, all kinds of work. It's a great website put together by Waldo Jaquith in the old days. I believe, I don't know if Waldo still keeps it together or someone else does. RichmondSunlight.com. That's a great place to go. David, just a few minutes left. What topic have I not asked about that you want to make sure that we talk about? You had mentioned energy and economics and medical marijuana. What do you, school work? Preschool education is something you always make sure to put together. Is there some topic?
Well, I think the one thing that I'd like to emphasize to folks is the ability for people to reach out to me. There are lots of ways they can get to me. I'm the only Toscano in the book, so far as I know. I'm very easy to find. You can go on davidtoscano.com, the website, and watch for a questionnaire I'll be sending out to almost everybody in my district, asking people for their views about the important issues facing the General Assembly. You know, they check them off and mail back the questionnaire, and I'll compile it all and publish it, and people will know what the priorities are. And call me in Richmond. Calling on bills really makes a difference. Sometimes if I only have one call on a bill that is not of major consequence, it may actually change my vote. That's how important people's input is in this process. So the earlier they can call or email me about bills that they're interested in, the better off we're all going to be.
And you do put out a how often do you put out your blog during the session?
During session is about once a week, maybe once every 8 days. But, you know, I try to keep people updated on what's going on, all the machinations, you know, the bills that are being considered and the ones that have been passed and ones that have failed. And it gives them an idea of what's going on.
And just to tell everybody, this is a budget session.
Yep.
So even more important. David, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, everybody. See you in 2018.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.